let a couple other people in, and we're good. All right. So, welcome everybody to this session, which is the last one before the summer in our Legal Ethics series from Beit Midrash Zichron Dov. This session is dedicated, as you can see on the source sheets, by Matthew Friedberg and Kim Smiley in memory of Matthew's father, Avram Mordechai ben Moshe, Zichron Livracha. This is accredited for 1.5 EDI professionalism credits. And if you registered in advance, you're fine. You don't need to sign in. I'm taking a list of those who are here that way, so that should work. If you did not register in advance, please do send me a note in the chat. And yes, answering that fellow who just wrote in the chat, yes, they now do messages and warnings that it's being recorded, and I think on the whole that's a good idea. So yes, you've been duly warned. A few just practical notes. First of all, this is being recorded, as everybody now knows. We're dealing with a really sensitive topic this morning. This topic of equality, diversity, of inclusion. I'd like to think that it's not in and of itself controversial. It's the Law Society's application of it that may be. I just want to remind everybody that whatever they say is being recorded, so be careful. This is your professional reputation on the line. What we're going to be doing is first talking about the problem, meaning talking about the challenges to equality, diversity, inclusion, as seen from the perspective of the Law Society, and we'll spend the first, I'd say, 20-25 minutes on that and what the Law Society has come up with as measures to try to deal with this. And then following that, we're going to move into the perspective of Judaism, Jewish tradition, Jewish law, on the issues of equality and diversity and inclusion. This is a 90-minute session. Everyone is duly warned of that as well. And I'm going to, again, put the link in the source sheet for the materials, since every time people join, they can't see what was in the chat before they joined in. Okay, I'm muting everybody by default at the outset, but again, unmute for questions and comments. My preference is for people to voice things out loud, as opposed to writing them in the chat. That way I don't have to worry about monitoring the chat during the session. So that I would appreciate that. Also, my preference is to see people. I recognize it's Sunday morning. Not everybody feels like they want to be seen. Nonetheless, if you're able to turn on your camera, that would be great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It's a lot easier to have a session that way. All right. So jumping into the history of this issue. This goes back to when the Law Society of Ontario was the Law Society of Upper Canada, back in the good old days. In 2011, the Law Society hired a firm to run a survey of law licensees on, quote, challenges facing racialized licensees. I kind of assume that at this point people are familiar with the term racialized, but in case not, race is fundamentally a political term. It's not a biological term. It's a term that society invents to describe certain people, and racialized means people who are grouped together with others by race, based on how they are viewed or based on their own self-identification. So they ran this survey in the middle of 2013, and they reported the following findings. They reported lower success rates, meaning harder time finding articling opportunities, finding a suitable first job, finding employment in a practice for racialized licensees. They reported less rapid career advancement than people with similar qualifications. They reported feeling disadvantaged in law school. Some of the specific issues that racialized licensees identified as causing them trouble were having a different accent, not being raised in Canada, not speaking English or French as well as others, being trained outside of Canada, not having a professional network, that was a big one, not sharing cultural background with others, prejudice from others. So the survey respondents, both those who identified as racialized and those who did not, contended that the challenges faced by racialized licensees affect the entire profession, and they affect the public as well. I'm going to turn to you to ask you, why would the challenge that faces a racialized licensee affect not just the licensee, but affect everybody? Why should this be so broad in its impact?
Can I say one thing, Robert Kirkman?
You could say many things, and you probably will.
No.
Go ahead.
You know who says no?
Yes, I do, Moshe.
Good. Very simple. I just want to know, a number of years ago, the Law Society allowed a number of participants that scored 50% on their exams, allowed them to become lawyers. Most of them are terrible. They're still terrible.
So I said I was going to let you talk, but I'm going to ask you to stick to the specific.
I'm just saying that was the problem by diversity.
Right. No, we're gonna talk about that. We are gonna get to that. But in terms of the point at hand, Moshe.
Yes, I'm just mentioning that point before you go further, just to know this was a major problem, and it's, I don't know now if it is now, but at that time they allowed lawyers in, they were never qualified.
Like I said, we're going to come back to the question of methods to deal with things, but I'm going to ask for an answer to the specific question that we're talking about. The challenges that they're faced and that they face, why should that affect the entire profession? Yes, Sergio.
Well, I think that the thought was that the entire society is disadvantaged by not integrating these people into the legal community. And also, if you see the history of that survey, it came in the context of a broader societal discussion. It was not isolated just when they decided that they're going to run the survey. It's part and parcel of the whole broader discussion in society at large, and not just restricted to the legal profession, but also affecting other professions.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. You are quite correct. This was something that came from a social movement. It wasn't someone's brainchild suddenly, hey, let's do a survey. And yes, it's viewed as affecting society as a whole. Yes, Ilan.
We miss out on opinions. We miss out on what people are saying. If a Jew were excluded from a legal career, we wouldn't get a Jewish opinion. Every opinion is not an opinion. It's important. And if we miss out on an opinion of one group of people that's excluded, then we're missing out on something that potentially is persuasive, maybe not in the current time, maybe in the past time, maybe in the future time, but something that contributes to the discussion, which as lawyers we're trying to make sense of.
Right. So this is definitely true. There's a fear that you will lose their input. Along with that, on a very concrete level, there's a concern about loss of access to justice within society. And this is something that we're going to flesh out in a little bit. But there's a great concern that in the event that you're not able to represent the demographics of society within the legal profession, the result of this is going to be that those who are members of that demographic will actually lose out when they need to look for legal representation. Aside from the impact on the legal professional, it could potentially have a broader impact on society. It affects access to justice, it affects quality of legal services, it affects the reputation of the legal system. Sergio mentioned that you have this debate going on in society about race. If people are able to turn to the Law Society and say, hey, why is it that racialized licensees are at a disadvantage? It's going to bring discredit to the profession on the whole. So that's another issue. And when I say the profession on the whole, I don't just mean the practice of law, but I mean the judicial system itself gets called into question.
And I could argue the exact opposite, though.
Yeah.
If we don't have inclusivity and it causes racialized people to start their own firms, because there's a need for that, then racialized people will have racialized firms to go to in the first place. If we include everybody, then those racialized firms won't exist.
Do you think so?
Yeah, actually, Rabbi,
I have a hard time imagining that that's actually correct.
But that's actually the experience of the Jewish community.
That's the exact experience of the Jewish lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
Right, the Jews were not allowed to join large, what were called the WASPI law firms in the 60s and until late into the 70s. So that's how a lot of Jewish law firms that are very, very large right now started.
So
it's also because we are the accounting firm. It's also because we are the accounting firm.
Right. So it may be true.
Rabbi, there's a very good book.
Yeah.
There's a very good book written by Malcolm Gladwell.
Yes.
It's one of his books, Outliers.
Yes.
And it has a whole chapter, I don't know if you've read it, explaining why some of the premier large American law firms that started predominantly Jewish became successful. And I think it is addressing and confirming all the points people before me have just made.
That's very interesting. Okay, well, I have to read. I've read part of Outliers. I clearly didn't get to the good part. I'm gonna go on a little bit further with this because that's all from 10 years ago. I want to fast forward to 2021. Events of the past year, since the killing of George Floyd, certainly, although really it's been building for the last few years before that, have pushed this forward even further. One of the objections to the EDI initiatives that we're going to be talking about has come from lawyers who have argued, I'm not racist. I work with lawyers of all ethnicities, all orientations. I have clients of all ethnicities. I have clients of all orientations. So what are you giving me a hard time for regarding, having to do special education and having to, fill out annual reports and all of that? Stop giving me a hard time. I'm not racist. That's essentially what I've heard, certainly, in discussing these issues with lawyers. But a concept has been introduced, which I think is actually a really important one, and one that Judaism has to be especially sensitive to. And the phrase I'm going to use is a phrase that I know some people don't like. In general, people who don't like catchphrases and code words may not like it. Nonetheless, I actually think it's very appropriate. And this is a term called systemic racism, or alternatively, implicit racism, or implicit bias, for those who prefer that. And what it recognizes is that racism may not be intentional. I turn your attention to the source sheet, and because some more people have joined, I'm going to again put the link for the source sheet in the chat. Take a look at source number one. This is from a fellow by the name of Hal Johnson. Hal Johnson is one of two people who run a television show, I understand, called Body Break. And he himself is multiracial, I believe Irish and black parents, I believe is what I had read. And the article came out last year, and it's called Yes, There Is Systemic Racism in Canada. Take a look at what he says. He says, yes, there is systemic racism in Canada. Too often, a white person will hire another white person who they can relate to. The bolding is mine. He says, people do. They hire those who remind them of themselves or of someone they know. He writes, I'm just going to mute everybody by default because I got some leak in someone's microphone. There we go. I do think this will change because young white people are more integrated and more exposed to diversity than ever before. Instead of seeing a black or Asian person across the table, they will see someone they may have grown up with. I was fortunate to grow up in Toronto's North York, in a predominantly Jewish neighborhood. When I eventually moved away, I would hear other friends of mine speak derogatory comments towards Jews. To me, they were not making a racial slur towards Jews. It was more personal than that. They were talking about my friends. When someone talks about your friends, you need to call them out. So he makes the point that that there is a certain built-in type of racism that can happen unintentionally just because someone doesn't look like you. He ties it into his connections with Jews, which I find interesting. But beyond what he's talking about, it can be built-in, something automatic, just the way the world works. And I turn to the National Post editorial board in source number two. In an article, What is Systemic Racism? There is broad national confusion about the concept. They write, there is broad national confusion about this concept. The suggestion that Canadian society is racist can sound insulting, because if Canada is racist, then Canadians themselves must be racist and full of hate. This sense of insult is an obstacle to understanding what systemic racism means. A claim about society blurs into a claim about an individual. Systemic racism can come across as an accusation. One way out of this mess is to get over oneself, and the part that I bolded. The idea of systemic racism is not about individual attitudes. It is about how society works. Good people can participate in systemic racism. And I'm skipping the specific example that the editorial board gave just to explain it from my own perspective. We're going to see some examples shortly. What it means is a person can be entirely race neutral in their approach. They can be, as people like to say about themselves, colorblind. They can work with people of every race. They can work with people of every orientation. They can have clients of every race, clients of every orientation. Nonetheless, there can be things that are built into the system that are going to disadvantage certain people. And we're going to talk about that with examples. But that's what we mean when we say systemic racism. It means you're not a racist. And yet, people of a particular race can be disadvantaged anyway, even though it has nothing to do with you as an individual. When we get to the examples, we'll see more of what this is about. But take a look at source number three. This comes from the original report that they came out with. Racialized licensees were twice as likely as non-racialized to report having felt disadvantaged in law school. Racialized licensees reported lower success rates across a range of key measures. I mentioned this already earlier, so I'm skipping through this. They were twice as likely as their non-racialized counterparts to report less rapid career advancement than their colleagues with similar qualifications, 52% compared to 25%. More than 4/5 of racialized licensees and 3/5 of non-racialized licensees agreed that racialized licensees face much more or somewhat more challenges to their entry into practice and advancement compared to their non-racialized colleagues. Now, a study like this is always going to be biased based on who chooses to respond. So you know that going in. Nonetheless, I think it is significant when 62% of those who say we are not racialized believe that others are in fact facing a disadvantage. At least half of respondents in both groups agreed that the challenges faced by racialized licensees impact the reputation of the legal system, affect access to justice for Ontarians, affect the quality of legal services for the public. Flipping the page, I brought you updated data from 2018. And this is from a Law Society study of the percentage of the number of lawyers in the population from each demographic compared to the percentage they make up of general society. So when you look down at it, and I specifically boxed the columns that I think are most relevant here, you find under black, you find that they represent 3.54% of lawyers, but 4.2% of the population. Chinese, 3.95% of lawyers, 5.41% of the general population. Not everybody is in that position. Japanese, for example, are reported as being 0.19% of lawyers, but 0.14% of the population. Ditto the other way for the Korean population. So it's not true for everybody that if you're part of a defined and different race, you're automatically going to be underrepresented. The upshot of this, though, is that in the event that particular races are having trouble succeeding in the field of law, then there is going to be an impact on the overall population. Take a look at source number five, please. Source number five, as well as source six, as well as source seven, come from a paper called Lawyers of Color and Racialized Immigrants with Foreign Legal Degrees from the International Journal of Criminology and Sociological Theory from 2009. So listen to this story. Of the 800 Chinese-speaking lawyers in Ontario, very few practice criminal or family or public interest or human rights law. We are going to find them is in general practice or corporate commercial and real estate law. I don't know why that is, but that's the observation, is that Chinese licensees practice certain sectors of law. So when I was on the articling subcommittee, the writer says, an application came in from an Asian lawyer who previously practiced criminal law in an Asian Commonwealth country for several years. This lawyer made a formal request to the Law Society for abridged articles due to the years of experience. The discussion around the table, and this is the part I bolded, the discussion around the table was there are plenty of criminal lawyers in Toronto. Right? We don't need to accelerate his articling. But I knew I could count on one hand the number of Chinese-speaking lawyers in Toronto practicing criminal law, a city with a population of 350,000 Chinese. I knew the Chinese community's need for Chinese-speaking criminal lawyers. What was missing from the discussion was the cultural and linguistic context of that request. They weren't paying attention to the fact that the Chinese community may have a need for Chinese-speaking criminal lawyers. And that's an example of something that could fairly be called systemic. In other words, nobody on that articling committee is racist. They're not. It's not about being racist. However, they're also not paying attention to what the needs of that community could be. And saying that, you know, it would be to their advantage to have somebody, because if you talk about somebody who is being accused of committing a crime, they might really want to turn to somebody who they feel safer with, someone who has the same background that they do, and so on. This becomes an issue. You know, the same way that people will go, the same way that people go to doctors, real estate agents, insurance agents who share their background, there's a level of trust. They would like to be able to have somebody who shares their background as well. Yes, Zevi.
We live in a free market society. If there's a need, I guarantee it's going to be met. There are a hell of a lot more Jewish criminal lawyers than there are Jewish criminals. I don't understand.
Is that true?
Context of this at all. I don't understand why this.
Don't be so sure.
I'm not sure we're getting there. I just don't know where we're going with this. If there is a need for Chinese criminal lawyers, a Chinese lawyer will step up and fill that void, I guarantee you.
Well, yes, but it may take time to get them because you're not making it available. It could be that it will happen. It'll balance out over a period of time. But there are people who are going to meet challenges in that period of time first. You know, Sergio, I'm going to ask you to hold off.
General point, which yeah. is, if you ask 9 out of 10 people on the street what's meant by systemic racism, right?
Yeah.
Stockwell Day was not forced off all his positions and jobs with a number of other people that were in the media because he insisted there was no such thing as systemic. He didn't insist. He just expressed the opinion that he didn't believe there was systemic racism in Canada. What I would see as systemic racism is that in the institutions of the country and in the marketplace, there is a predisposition not to allow certain people to participate. And I found that, in my experience, hard to believe. Okay, I'm not...
So, I mean, wait, what you're talking about may well be a class of racism that is or isn't. But that's not where I'm going with this. I'm going with the literal definition of systemic racism, and it's not about ill will. It's not about trying to harm people. It's about just problems that exist within a system just because of where things came from. Let me, you know, Zevi, I'm looking at the clock. I'm looking at the clock, and I wanted 20 to 25 minutes on the background, and we're at 21 now because we started at 9:35. So I want to get through this in order to get to what all of this means from a Jewish standpoint. So just highlighting some examples of this. You have situations in which information on entering law and qualifying for legal practice is not publicly available in a way that is going to be helpful for people. I'm going to first read you one case in source number 6, and then I'll talk about it from my own experience. Deepa Matu, who is now a lawyer with the South Asian Legal Clinic of Ontario, identifies some of the common experiences of racialized foreign lawyers and National Committee on Accreditation students. When I applied, I was not aware that I needed documents from my law school in India. Given that there are no websites or email addresses for many Indian institutions, I had to return to India to retrieve these documents before continuing the accreditation process. Despite the specific criteria, I found the discretion to be very broad and not transparent. In fact, it can be vague and uneven, and at times it seems arbitrary. I know one student who approached the NCA twice. The first time, he was told he had to write 8 exams. The next time, he was told to write 14 exams without any clear rationale for the discrepancy. This happens all the time. All in all, I conclude, this was the most isolating experience that I've ever had. Now, my wife trained in the U.S. She went to a law school you may have heard of, right? It's called Harvard Law School. When we moved to Canada 12 years ago, she had to go through such hoops trying to figure out whether she could recertify. They weren't sure whether they were happy with all the courses she had taken and whether that school was up to the standards of Canada. Different material in different places about what is required for certification and which exams you have to take. And finally, she said, you know what? I work for an American law firm. I don't actually need to recertify. And so she didn't. 12 years later, she didn't recertify. But for us, as number one, English speakers, number two, she had a job from the U.S. that she was able to keep. So it was annoying, but fine, let it go. If you imagine somebody who doesn't know the... I'm going to stick with the mute for now. If you imagine somebody who doesn't have the language, somebody who doesn't know the culture, and somebody who is vulnerable, somebody who doesn't have the luxury of having a job already that they're able to keep, this can be a very real and substantive nightmare. So, I don't think this should be taken lightly. I think this is a problem. And again, not born out of ill intent.
It's called bureaucracy, not racism.
But that's exactly my point, Zevi. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make. Mrs. Whitty, I see your hand. Just hang in there. That's exactly the point I'm trying to make. This isn't about ill will. This isn't about people, driving around with a bumper sticker saying that they hate fill-in-the-blank, race. This is about a system that has flaws in it, which will disadvantage some people more than others. That's all that's Michael, that's, go back to my point before about systemic racism. That's what we're talking about. We're talking about source number 7, which I'm not going to read aloud in the interest of time, talking about how there's information on the articling process that's not available in different languages. Now, you may say, well, too bad. If you want to practice law in Canada, you should be able to speak English, French, both, whatever. I understand that. But this is, this is the trade-off that you end up with. And the last piece within this, and then I'll take Mrs. Whitty's comment, but then I want to get to the Jewish part of this because this is supposed to be a Jewish ethics thing. At source number 8, I brought an interview with a woman by the name of Arlene Huggins. She's a lawyer. And she talks about how when she was a law student at U of T, other students making the assumption that there was some kind of a quota program in which they would allow black students, even if they did not merit it. What she says was not existent at the time. She talks about people in courtrooms, in courthouses, who mistake her for a court clerk. This is something which, on a very personal level, can be damaging. Mrs. Whitty, thank you for your patience.
Sorry. I imagine this has happened to a lot of people on this call, but as a visibly Orthodox Jewish person, I've experienced that prejudice. Once actually at a session which was designed to deal with this question of racialized lawyers, we were the control group, and someone pointed to me and said, well, of course I wouldn't hire her because she's obviously going to have a half dozen kids and take a bunch of mat leaves, and what do I need that for, not to mention the Fridays and holidays.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I'm...
If you can imagine those assumptions that are made about me because I look Orthodox Jewish, only to another Jew, but okay. Certainly, I can imagine someone else whose minority status is more visible experiencing more of it.
Right. Right. Your mic is causing some problems, so... But yes, I think fundamentally your point got across. I'm not turning this into a debate about whether there is or is not. That's not where this is going. Mrs. Basser.
Okay. So, being a paralegal, I see that what's happening, since the number 5 source you gave, notice dated from 2009.
Yes.
Okay, since 2007, the Law Society has licensed paralegals. And what happened is many of these people who could have perhaps become lawyers in Canada are going through the paralegal systems. I'm a professor at Humber College in the grad cert program, and 50% of my class is lawyers from other countries. They have decided to opt into that method. And so the paralegal profession is getting, or is has turned into the place for most of these people, and they work predominantly in their own communities. They service their own communities, and many of them do go into criminal. Even though paralegals can only deal with summary convictions, it's becoming much more easy. It's becoming very easy for paralegals to work in that system because most things are summary. So, in the end, that's where they're going.
Yeah.
Because they've given up on the law society.
Wow.
There's too much difficulties. Like you said, it hasn't gotten any easier. They're unable to do it. And nobody, and the paralegal world is just accepting them. And that's how this has turned. And that's what this has turned into. It's not what the law society ever envisioned for paralegals, but it's exactly what's happening.
Very interesting. Okay, I'm going to go further here. Just, again, it's getting late and we have a lot to talk about. The Law Society of Ontario, like other law societies around Canada, has determined that it has a duty to act in ways that some lawyers are happy with and some lawyers are not happy with. I gave you a link in source number 9 where you can find their recommendations from 2016. But basically what it comes down to is this. Number one, they want to ensure that lawyers are complying with EDI, Equality, Diversity, and Inclusion policies and initiatives. So there is now an annual requirement to acknowledge human rights laws. And that was first in one form, and then it became in a different form, thanks to the Stop-Sop slate, which we're going to talk about. There was a requirement for a diversity policy if you have 10 licensees in your firm addressing discrimination, harassment, and so on. And there's a requirement for CPD in the field of EDI. That's what you're doing here. As of 2021, the obligation is 1 hour per year. Second, in addition to ensuring lawyers are complying with EDI policies and initiatives, the Law Society is supposed to issue public reports on an inclusion index based on responses from firms with 25 or more licensees. And they're also supposed to be tracking progress of diversity largely through the annual reports, filings of members, So they're supposed to be collecting demographic data. They have statistics up on their website for paralegals and legal and lawyers running up to 2018. They have voluntary inclusion questions asking about your experience and what you have observed to be the experience of others. They have self-assessment questions about your firm's policies. There's an inclusion survey that was done in 2017 that's supposed to be redone every 4 years, but I haven't found anything about this being done in 2021. I don't know if that's a COVID casualty or it was too hard to do 4 years ago. I don't know. But there has been pushback on this and opposition to EDI initiatives. And this goes back to Stop-Sop. The argument goes that, number one, it's Orwellian for the Law Society to become involved in this. Enforcement of the law should be with the courts and not with the profession. So I brought you articles on this from 2019 in source number 11 as well as in source number 12. For those who are here who don't know what Stop-Sop was, you can read the articles. But basically there was a statement of principles which the Law Society wanted lawyers to have to affirm. And the argument was that this was indeed inappropriate infringement on free speech. And more than that, you can take a look at sources 11 and 12. And there was a slate of lawyers who were elected to the panel who got that downgraded somewhat to an acknowledgement of relevant human rights law. Another argument was, why are you singling out lawyers? Why do we specifically need this kind of oversight, this kind of education requirement, this public affirmation? Doesn't exist in other fields. I should note that the College of Physicians and Surgeons in Ontario does have an EDI initiative, but it has not gone to the extent that the lawyers' division has gone. It is not as, it's not nearly as robust. And then a third argument is that some of what's being done is symbolic. It's performative. It's window dressing. you know, like self-assessments on diversity. If you take a look at source number 13, I brought you one of the self-assessment questions. Your legal workplace formally considers opportunities to support equality, diversity, and inclusion when making decisions about, and then select all that apply. Recruitment, hiring, advancement, promotion, training and development, mentoring, assignment of work, or none of the above. So how many lawyers are really going to check none of the above? No, we don't support EDI on any of these things. And it's not like you have to back it up. It's simply there. So that in source number 14, is a paper that appeared in the Ottawa Law Review regarding the statement of principles. This fellow who was writing was trying to defend the statement of principles, but along the way, he made a point which could be argued against him, in which he said, really, the whole thing you have to do is say, I acknowledge my existing professional and human rights obligations. That's all you have to say. It's a meaningless statement. And he goes on to give examples of things you could say that would actually be hostile as long as you included, I acknowledge my existing professional and human rights obligations. But the very fact that it doesn't really require anything of substance leads to an argument that this is just window dressing. Why are you making me do it? And that's another argument in this regard. So what I want to do is look at all of these issues from the perspectives of Jewish ethics, Jewish law. And what we're going to address are the following questions. Number one, in terms of the underlying issues that are behind all of this, does Judaism speak to issues of inclusion? Does Judaism speak to issues of racial diversity? Does Judaism speak to issues of systemic racism? That's the first part of where I want to go. And then, in terms of the controversy surrounding EDI initiatives, does Judaism believe in regulating professional activities for ethical conduct? Which goes back to the question that was raised in the very beginning about admitting people on the basis of race and changing standards on the basis of race. And does Judaism believe in the value of symbolic gestures? If you're going to say that this is just symbolic, does Judaism believe that that actually is something one, you know, has value? And if there's time, I'll give an observation about the core, what I think is the core of the problem here, that underlies a lot of this. But let's move into talking about the issue of inclusion, the concern for people not feeling isolated, like the case that we mentioned from Arlene Huggins, who says that people come up to her and assume that she's a clerk and don't recognize that she could be a lawyer. If you take a look at number 15 on the sheet, this comes from the inclusion survey that the Law Society expects lawyers to fill out annually. I am included in informal social gatherings, e.g. coffee, lunch, etc., at my legal workplace. Always, often, sometimes, rarely, never, I do not know, not applicable, I do not wish to answer. So you can check a box on whether you are included in informal social gatherings. So that's clearly not about the practice of law. It's about how do you feel at your firm? Do you feel like you're part of the group, part of the community? And that issue of feeling like one is part of the community is really, really important within Judaism. First of all, on a personal level, in terms of a person's self-image, tell me something. Where is the first time we find in the Torah that inclusion is important? First time in the Torah that we find inclusion emphasized. If you're looking at the source sheet, that's cheating. But admirable.
Yishmael?
That's interesting. Why?
He's the opposite.
Well, he's excluded.
Excluded and doesn't feel very good about it.
Yeah. Well, we don't know how he feels, actually. He doesn't get interviewed.
Yisrael, maybe?
What do you mean?
Well, he was an outsider. He was a priest of Midian.
Mm-hmm.
And our devotion went a long way to make him feel welcome. He came out.
Right.
They had a big suitor for him.
So you're right. Yisrael, Moshe's father-in-law, is on the outs in Midian. I'm going to go much earlier. Take a look at source number 16. The Garden of Eden. Vayitzav Hashem Elokim al ha'adam. You know what? I'm going to stick with the English in the interests of time. God instructed the man, saying, from every tree of the garden you shall eat, and from the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat. On the day you eat of it, you shall die. So God first gives human beings a mitzvah. God says, you have an obligation to me. This is your relationship with God. Don't eat from this tree. And immediately after that, God says, it is not good for the man to be alone. I shall make him a help opposite him. Ezer Kenegdo, a help opposite him. Human beings do not do well when they are alone. Now, there's obviously a lot of Torah on what this means. Were Adam and Eve separate people? Were they both together within one body initially and then separated off? There's a lot to say about it. But on a very basic level, right after the Torah establishes the relationship between human being and God, it establishes the relationship between human being and other human beings, and it says it's not good for the human being to be alone. And then Adam goes looking for a mate among the other things God has created, can't find one, and then we end up with Adam and Chava, with Adam and Eve. So the importance of the human relationship and of being a social creature is right there in the very beginning of the Torah. And it becomes a very powerful force in Judaism. Yeah, I was learning with one of my kids on Shabbos, and we were talking about the different penalties that are at the dispensation of a rabbinical court, classically, not in our day, but going back to when judges were judges, so to speak, in the times of the Talmud. And it's very interesting to realize that one of the most severe penalties a court could give is something called sometimes cherem, sometimes shamta, sometimes it's called nidui, and what it means is excommunication, drawing the person out of society for a period of time. And that was considered the equivalent of death. So much so that somebody who was excommunicated conducted rituals like those of mourning. This affects Jewish law. If you take a look at source number 17, the Rambam, Maimonides, in Hilchos Yom Tov, in the Laws of Holidays, says something striking. He says, when eating and drinking, one must all, meaning on the festival, on the holiday, one must also feed the stranger, the orphan, and the widow with all other paupers and needy people. Now, if I stopped there, I could say, sure, this is tzedakah. Right? We have loads of mitzvot of tzedakah, of helping other people out. So it's telling me, for Pesach, for Sukkot, for Rosh Hashanah, whatever, make sure that people have food. That's very nice. But that's not what it says. Keep on reading. He says, for one who closes his yard's gates and eats and drinks with his children and wife and does not feed the needy and people of bitter spirit, this is not joy of a mitzvah, it is joy of his belly. What he says is, not just that you have to make sure people have, but you have to make sure people have with you. Meaning, invite guests. Invite people over. It's not only about taking care of their financial needs, it's about taking care of their emotional needs and actually inviting them. And we have mitzvot like this of inclusion, and in particular, we have prohibitions regarding exclusion. So as an example, if you take a look at sources 18 and 19, two verses from the Torah that speak about excluding vulnerable people. Do not curse the deaf. Do not put a stumbling block before the blind, right? When somebody has a weakness, you have to be careful about the way you act. Don't cause them harm. And in number 19, you shall neither abuse a stranger nor oppress him, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. You have to be careful with people who are vulnerable. On a practical level, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein mentioned this, regarding the issue of welcoming people who are disabled, and specifically developmentally disabled, intellectually disabled, in the synagogue. When he said, when they come to the synagogue, he's talking about people who are developmentally disadvantaged. When they come to the synagogue, the congregation must greet them pleasantly, even when they cannot learn with the community. They must see to it that such children answer Amen and Kedusha, saying it with them so they will do what they can, and so as to honor their parents as well. This has value for the children themselves. They fulfill whatever they can, as even walking to synagogue is a mitzvah, and they can kiss the Torah scroll. But the part that I'm emphasizing here is where he says, make sure that they feel welcome within the community. That's really, really important. On a personal level, people have to feel included, and it's also important on a national level. The following is about leadership in the community. Take a look, please, at source number 21. Source number 21 is a midrash that's dealing with the creation of the Mishkan. The Mishkan is the traveling temple, portable temple that the Jews had from after they left Egypt until they entered into Israel and then continued to be used for centuries thereafter in the land until the building of the temple in Jerusalem. So the in source number 21, you know, I'm going to say it outside of the text because otherwise it'll be confusing. We learned that there were two people who were at the helm in terms of building the Mishkan. One was Bezalel from the tribe of Judah, which is the royal tribe in Judaism. That's where the kings came from. And the other was Aholiab. Aholiab came from the tribe of Dan, which was the least of the tribes. Dan was the one who traveled last in the wilderness. Dan was the one whose mother was a maid originally for Rachel. They, and the two of them, representing these two opposite ends, are involved in creating the Mishkan. Similarly, as the text goes on to note, the Beit HaMikdash, the temple in Jerusalem, is built by Shlomo, King Solomon, and a key person in the building process is a fellow by the name of Hiram. Not to be confused with Hiram, but Hiram is a different person. Hiram is the son of a widow from the tribe of Naphtali. His father, according to Don Isaac Abarbanel, may not have been Jewish. And the two of them pair together to build the Beit HaMikdash, to build, to create the temple in which we pray. We incorporate both ends of that political spectrum within Judaism. And last I noted for you here, that in source number 22, we are taught that there was an era in Jewish history, a period of centuries, called the era of the judges. After Joshua died, and before the monarchy began, the Jews were led by Shoftim. Some of them were actual judges, some of them were political leaders, but they're called judges, all of them. So the Talmud states there was not a single tribe which did not produce a judge, meaning the judges came from across the spectrum of the tribes of Israel. Each tribe produced at least one prophet. It was from everybody. Now, I have to note when I say this, two things. Number one, when you start talking about political leadership, this is male. And that's a whole other discussion about male versus female in this regard, but I want to, you know, acknowledge that up front. And number two, when you get to royalty, the kings do only come from the tribe of Judah. There's a lot of discussion about that. Don Isaac Abarbanel didn't agree. He thought that it was not did not necessarily have to be so, but that is the way it played out. But what I'm trying to show here is, on a personal level, like inviting guests over for Yom Tov, again, when it's not COVID, fine, that's a whole other discussion. When it comes to being careful of the feelings of others, inclusion becomes really important personally. And it becomes important in terms of the way that we run our nation. So that, to me, is a very important point. Inclusion is not some, from a Jewish perspective, is not some late-breaking idea of saying, you know, you guys don't have to rough it out there, we're going to welcome you in. It's something that is core to Judaism itself. Number two, the issue of racial diversity. So first, I want to emphatically say that Judaism is against racism. From a Jewish perspective, we are all created spiritually equal. Going back to the beginning of the Torah, if you take a look at source number 23, Rav Aaron Soloveitchik on this point in an essay called Civil Rights and the Dignity of Man, he wrote, this essay, I believe, goes back to the 70s and 80s, but I'm not 100% sure. He says, the Torah says in Genesis, in the image of God, he created man. This metaphysical idea leads to the halachic principle of kvod habrios, the dignity of man. We have a principle in Jewish law that human dignity is an important factor to be weighed when dealing with halachic questions. He says it's because the Torah says we were created in the image of God, which is not about Jews. It's all human beings. It goes back to the very beginning. And he writes, the concept of dignity of man is not only a metaphysical concept, but it also has a legal counterpart, whose scope is broad enough to include all human beings, since all were created in the image of God. This idea is contained in the saying of Ben Azai, back to the time of the Mishnah 2,000 years ago, despise not any man. The expression any man implies, as the commentaries say, that even pagans must be treated with respect, and it is a sin to despise them. And yes, even though the word used in the Hebrew is man, the word is Adam, and it applies to all human beings, not only males. So this is a point which he's not the only one to make, but he happens to have made it very clearly and explicitly, and that's why I cite it. And I will also note source number 24, a Mishnah in Sanhedrin, going back 2,000 years in Jewish history. This is part of what courts would say to witnesses. When witnesses are going to testify in a case, the court wants to warn them of the seriousness of the ramifications of their testimony and the impact on whoever they're testifying against. And as part of that warning, the Mishnah records the following. This is why man was created as an individual, meaning when you look in the biblical account of creation, all species other than human beings are created male and female and multiple sets of male and female. Only human beings start out as an individual. And there are this Mishnah here in 24 brings a series of reasons why God would want to start with human beings as an individual. And one of the reasons that's brought, right, one of the reasons is the famous idea in Judaism that each life is an entire world, right, because we started as one human being. But here's another one. And for peace among people, lest one person say to another, my ancestor was greater than your ancestor. Doesn't work that way. All of us, all ethnicities, all races begin from the same source. And lest races say there are multiple gods, because you'd say, well, this God created this one and that God created that one. And to proclaim the greatness of God. For a person mints many coins with one seal and they all resemble each other. Right? Normally, if I create some system for minting coins, they all look alike. And the blessed, holy King of Kings minted each person with the seal of Adam the First, and not one resembles the other. The glories of DNA. So, the point is that diversity is presented as part of God's plan from the beginning. That's the idea here. And this philosophy has had practical applications in Judaism. For example, when was it that the general Jewish world became aware that there were people in Ethiopia who claimed to have Jewish heritage? When did that begin? Anybody know? Want to guess? I've been monologuing to make up for lost time, but I'll ask the question.
Probably in the 60s.
So that's what I think most people would think, the 1960s. It's not so. In the year 1864, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, head of a rabbinical seminary in Germany, endorsed sending Torah scholars to Ethiopia to learn with people there who said they were Jewish. That was repeated by Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cook in the year 1912. There was never any mention of, wait a minute, they're Ethiopian, they're black, they can't be Jewish. That was not a factor in decision making, so much so that if you take a look at source number 25, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, writing in the latter half of the 20th century, says, I was very pained to hear there are such people in Israel who refrain from drawing near the Ethiopians in spiritual matters, causing them, God forbid, to be lost from Judaism. It appears to do this only because their skin is black. It is obvious that one must draw them close, not only because they are no worse than other Jews and there is no legal distinction due to their blackness, and then he goes on. Source number 26, Rabbi J. David Bleich in 1972, Judaism is colorblind, skin pigmentation is unknown as a halachic concept. The problem of determining the status of the various communities of black Jews is totally unrelated to color. The sole issue is that of Jewish identity, by which he's talking about the question of, was Judaism actually transmitted and observed in Ethiopia? Did they get this from Jewish sources? Did it come from Christian missionaries? That's a whole other discussion. But he says it's not based on color. From the perspective of Jewish law, skin color is irrelevant. And not only that, but take a look at source number 27 from Rabbi Dr. Norman Lamb. As you see, a speech he gave in 1969. He writes, I deeply regret that in the past, those who are immersed in Judaism have largely failed to reach outward to other peoples. and those Jews who have reached outwards have usually had no real link with Judaism. As a result, for many people, civil rights became a religion in itself. The help to the black community became a substitute for Judaism when it should have been an expression and function of Judaism. What he's saying, and I don't mean to offend anyone who was involved in outreach pre his sermon, the point is not to condemn those who were involved in it, but rather to highlight, he says, it should have been, civil rights involvement should have been something taken on by those who are observant of Judaism, because it makes sense as a function of Judaism. It shouldn't be seen as something that is done by people who are not observant. He says Judaism should mandate that kind of activism. And so Judaism has taught that every race stands equally before God. I brought you a passage in Yeshaya, in Isaiah, which speaks of a future time when the Jews and Egypt and Assyria will all be linked together as God's portion. In number 29, I noted that we are taught that on Rosh Hashanah, all human beings, all who have entered the world, are judged by God. There's no difference, Jew, non-Jew, or different colors. So everything I've said for the last 15 minutes is probably obvious to most people here. I hope it is. But at the same time, you can't pretend that there's no racism among Jews. I mean, you gotta be kidding. There are Jews who are racist. Part of it is a human weakness. It's born from fear of the outsider. We saw it in source number 24, where the Mishnah said, someone might say, my ancestor was greater than your ancestor. There's a natural human tendency of fear of the outsider, someone who's perceived to be an outsider. In some part, it's just a display of poor character. We are vulnerable to the same weaknesses that everybody else in society has. Rabbi Dr. Shlomo Carmi, in a 2018 essay in source number 30, blamed some of it on racial issues in which Jews were vulnerable and attacked by other communities in North America. His case is in Brooklyn. He talks about in the 60s and early 70s visiting his family on St. Mark's Avenue in Brooklyn, and more than once a bottle whizzed past the visitor's ear and shattered on the pavement, accompanied by the hurler's hearty advice that Jews get off his turf. And he goes on to say, this is not really a good justification necessarily for racism, but as he writes, and I bolded at the end of the paragraph, all the same, the language of broken bones, though eloquent, is not nuanced. When people remember getting beaten, when people remember getting in fights as kids, when people remember being attacked and insulted, it's very hard to say to them, don't be racist. That's just a reality. But more than that, there are problems within Judaism. I made a mistake when I taught this class in 2019, the first time that I did an EDI session, in that I spent a lot of time trying to deal with the sources in Judaism that are challenging in this regard, that seem to present problems, like Ham being condemned, the son of Noah, being condemned to serve his brothers, or Amalek, which is an ethnicity, apparently, from the biblical text. But I realized then that I wouldn't get to anything else. So in source number 31, I gave you a link to a lecture that I've given a few, but this is one of them, on racism in Judaism. It was called Racism in Rosh Hashanah. And you can see more there about the fact that there are things in Judaism you do have to confront. There are sources that seem to support racist ideas, and you have to be careful for it. Not only that, what we're going to see in a little bit is that there's a potential for systemic racism within Judaism itself that you have to watch out for. So I'm going to come back to that in a little bit. But this is why Judaism's points regarding inclusion, which we talked about, matter so much. Because there are Jews who are racist, and there is a potential for it within Judaism. But to sum up what I'm trying to say about Judaism and racism is, while we acknowledge that there are certain problems within Judaism on this front, the mainstream position is what Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote in source number 32 and what Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky wrote in source number 33. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik writes, from the standpoint of the Torah, there can be no distinction between one human being and another on the basis of race or color. Any discrimination shown to a human being on account of the color of his or her skin constitutes loathsome barbarity. I was fortunate to hear Rav Aaron speak live when I was in high school. And that's like, I can hear his words. I can hear his voice saying loathsome barbaric. It's very him. But that's, you know, that's what he said. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky in source number 33, you can see it there, says, yeah, he describes it as an ugly trait. So because of this valuing of each person, and because of this stance against racism, we value ethnic diversity within Judaism. You know, the Law Society talks about why to value diversity. And it talks about correcting the challenges for racialized licensees. It talks about providing better legal services for the public. It talks about improving the image of the legal profession. Okay. Judaism points out two other things, one of which Michael mentioned before. If you take a look at source number 34, Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar, in a comment on Parshas Yisro, Rabbi Chaim ibn Attar writing, as you see, in 18th century North Africa, he's commenting on Moses' father-in-law being the one to teach Moses about the legal system, the judicial system that the Jews should employ, the hierarchy of courts. And he says, God could have taught us this directly, personally. Why does God need Yitro, Moshe's father-in-law, to teach that? And he says, it appears that God did this to show the children of Israel in that generation and every generation that the nations include giants of understanding and insight in order to understand there are things you can gain learning from others. And that's a critical perspective. The Israel was not selected due to greater insight and sense than other nations. Jews are not any smarter than anybody else, standardized testing notwithstanding. The Nobel Prizes notwithstanding. We're not. Everybody's got brains. And the diversity is important in order to ensure that every voice is going to be expressed. What's special about us is not our national bloodline. That's number one. And number two, and this goes back to what I said earlier in source number 24, it's part of the divine plan for there to be diversity. In source number 24, we said God wanted to mint one human being who would generate human beings who would look different, who would be different. In source number 35, I brought you a passage from the Talmud in Brachot, which talks about a blessing to be said when you see a large crowd. Why? For their intellects do not resemble each other and their forms do not resemble each other. Why this says Jewish crowds in particular is a great discussion for another point in time. But the point is, to answer our question of what Judaism says regarding racial diversity, number one, it is a generally anti-racist philosophy in Judaism, and number two, the diversity is specifically valued. Clear? I'm going to pause for a moment to breathe. Okay. We're still not back on track in terms of timing, but we're getting closer. So what about what I alluded to before, the possibility of systemic racism within Judaism? Judaism has very much a potential for systemic bias, not based on color. We've said before that color is not a thing from a Jewish perspective, from a halachic perspective, but rather based on insider and outsider. There is privilege given to family over the outsider. Classic example. The Torah states in Parshat Emor, it gives this story, I gave you a verse from it in source number 36, Leviticus chapter 24. There was an incident involving a man who was born to a Jewish mother and an Egyptian father, and somebody else within the Jewish camp. Here, we'll take a look at it, number 36. And the son of an Israelite woman, the son of an Egyptian man, went out among the children of Israel. He was born to a Jewish woman, Egyptian man. The sages teach this is the only case that we know of the child of an intermarriage in the period in Egypt. So he goes out among the children of Israel, and they fought in the camp, the son of the Israelite woman and the Israelite man. There was a fight between this fellow and somebody else. It doesn't tell us what the fight was about. What triggered this fight? So the Midrash fills it in for you in source number 37. From where did he depart? It says he went out among the children of Israel. Where was he coming out of? from Moshe's court, for he came to plant his tent in the camp of Dan. He comes to the camp of Dan, the last of the camps when the Jews travel, the tribe of Dan, and he says, I want to set up my tent here. And the reason why Dan, we'll see in a moment. They said to him, who are you to plant in the camp of Dan? You don't have any land here. And he said, I am from the daughters of Dan, which he was. His mother was Shlomit Bat Divri from the tribe of Dan. So he says, my mother is from Dan. And they said to him, the text says, each with his flag by the signs according to their father's house, the children of Israel shall camp. It's based on paternity. It's not based on who your mother is, right? We say that Jewish identity goes with the mother, but tribal identity was with the father. He entered Moshe's court. He sued. He went to Beit Din, and he lost. He departed having lost, and he stood and he blasphemed against God, and that's this whole incident that that is told in Leviticus chapter 24. What this story shows us, leave aside the particular event now, extrapolate the lesson, is the disadvantage that somebody who's coming from the outside faces. We privilege the family over the outsider in certain ways. That's one of the reasons why we pushed back on it earlier and said, you have to welcome the stranger and take care of the stranger and don't abuse the stranger, because you know this is built into the system as a potential disadvantage. Another example, we give privilege to the righteous over those who are not known as righteous. If you take a look at source number 38, passage in the Talmud, there's a verse in Genesis, in Bereshit, the sister of Lotan was Timna. Now, Timna, we know, becomes a concubine to Esav, and their son is, to Eliphaz, the son of Esav, and their son is Amalek, who hates the Jews. So, look at the backstory here. Who was this woman, Timna? Timna was a daughter of kings, as the text says, Aluf Lotan, Aluf Timna, it lists a whole bunch of leaders of clans. Each Aluf is an uncrowned empire, so she is part of royalty. And look what the Talmud tells you about her. She wanted to convert. Conversion before the Torah is given is not what conversion is today, but she wants to join the family of Abraham. She comes to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. They didn't accept her. She became a concubine for Eliphaz, son of Esav, saying, better a maid for this nation, not a matron for another nation. She wants to join the Jewish people. She can't do it. She finally ends up becoming a concubine for Esav. And Amalek, who pained Israel, emerged from her because they should not have distanced her. This passage is warning about the bias on behalf of members of the covenant and those who are viewed as righteous against others. And I bring you another example of it in source number 39. A passage in the Talmud, there's a mistake there. I wrote Sanhedrin 53b. It should be Psachim 53b. I'm not sure why I wrote Sanhedrin. Which teaches that anyone who provides merchandise for a Torah scholar, meaning so that he can go do business, if you will help him by getting him merchandise that he can sell, you merit to sit in Yeshiva Shamala in the Heavenly Academy. Well, that's a very nice thing to do. We're trying to support Torah study. But recognize that it involves, again, a support for this person and not for others. We do have certain ways in which we give advantages to insiders, to people who excel, perhaps from a religious perspective. And you have to know that that can create problems in the other direction. You have to recognize that. That's why inclusion becomes really important from a Jewish perspective. Last note on this from source number 48, from an essay by Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. It was actually someone's record of a class that he taught. It wasn't an essay of his. He points out the rule of Gezel Hager. Anybody know what Gezel Hager is? What is Gezel Hager? Not so much. I mean, it does happen as part of it. So get.
We dealt with it in the parsha recently.
Yes.
Steal from somebody, and you have to return it to them, and they're dead, and they don't have any heirs. So say who doesn't have any heirs? It's a ger who doesn't have heirs, and then you have to return it to the kohen.
Right. Thank you. So what happens is, if somebody converts to Judaism, does not get married, and does not build any relationships among the Jews, at some point is a victim of a theft. The thief wants to, at some point, return it, but the person who he stole from has died, and there are no halachic heirs. So what do you do with that? That's the law of Gezel Hager. It's supposed to be given to the Kohen, given to the priest, as a means of some level of atonement. There's a lot to say about that. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein points out, though, that it's placed in a very strange place in the Torah. It's not among the other laws of theft. It appears, as Michael noted, in Parshas Behar, Parshas Naso, the Torah reading, not from yesterday, but from the week before. And it comes in right after a census of all the Jews, a listing of their families, a listing of how the tribes would all travel in the wilderness. After that, so take a look at source number 40, where Rav Aaron Lichtenstein makes the following observation. While Judaism sees the family and the nation as central to Jewish identity and consciousness, it is well aware of the danger to which these loyalties can lead when taken to an extreme. It is for this reason that we are commanded with regard to Gezel Hager in the middle of Parshat Naso. It is precisely the ger, the foreigner, lacking the sense of familial tribal and national roots, who is most vulnerable to the atmosphere pervading the beginning of Sefer Bamidbar. Therefore, the Torah commands us here to deal with the ger exactly as we would with our fellow Israelites, that you have to return it and so on. That's the idea. That's what it's doing here, is because of a recognition that there is a risk built in because of our emphasis on family. So systemic racism is not a new concept. The idea that there are certain biases that are built in having nothing to do. You're a good person. You don't hate anybody and you're open and colorblind and so on. Nonetheless, there are ways in which the outsider can suffer. So those were the easy parts. What we just did within Judaism are the easy parts. Meaning, again, as I said before, I would hope everybody would recognize that Judaism is not promoting racism, that Judaism is in favor of inclusion, in favor of diversity, and maybe this last part was new for some people to think about, the issues of implicit bias within Judaism. But where I want to go now is some of the more controversial issues that were raised in the beginning of the session, which is, what about when it comes to regulating professional activities for ethical conduct, and specifically the question that was raised, you're admitting people to the bar, potentially, or to law school, on the basis of a quota in certain circumstances, even if they don't do as well on tests, where would Judaism fall out on that kind of activism? So, again, because Jewish law does not imagine discrimination based on skin color, it doesn't address this question directly. But it does imagine, as we just saw, discrimination on other grounds, the foreigner, the vulnerable, and it does address that, and particularly in the practice of law. Right? A verse we've discussed in a variety of settings when we talk about access to justice in source number 41, the verse from Leviticus, you shall have one justice for yourself, like stranger, like citizen. One system of justice for everybody, mishpat echad. That's, you know, an imperative for access to justice for everybody. Further, within law, again, we are mandated to help those who are disadvantaged. The mission of the court is, and Maimonides quotes it here in source number 42, Lahatzil Ashuk Miyad Oshko. He's talking about the criteria for judges. And one criterion is they should be men of Chayil, which he explains means they have to have a brave heart to save the abused from one who would abuse him. And he quotes the verse like when Moshe saves the daughters of Yitro in Midian. And because of this principle, because we talk about the importance of saving the vulnerable, that results in a charge to courts in source number 43, saying that the courts have a responsibility which is best captured in a verse from Mishlei, from Proverbs, Psach picha le'ilem, open your mouth for the mute. Now, this is a very tricky thing for courts to carry out, but what it means is courts are obligated to try to help potentially disadvantaged litigants, without giving the impression of being biased towards them. So in the example in source number 43 from the Talmud, there is a principle that every 7 years, any loan that is in default is abolished. in the Shemitah year, the end of the Shemitah year. This coming year is a Shemitah year, so it's going to come up in September, not of 2021, but in September of 2022. That loans that are in default are gone. However, a loan can survive that if there is a document prepared called a prosbul. I'm not going into the ins and outs of prosbul right now. But look at source number 43. Case comes to Rav, a leading sage in the 3rd century Common Era, in which the creditor claims payment of a debt. The borrower says, I don't know what you're talking about. The sabbatical year passed. My loan is gone. Creditor's out of luck. Shrugs. Doesn't know what to do. Rav would ask the creditor, did you have a prosbul and it was lost? Even though it's really the creditor's job to make that claim. It's not the judge's job to make that claim. Nonetheless, he did it as a means of helping those who he felt were at a disadvantage. That's in terms of the practice of law in the field, so to speak, and access to justice. But what about when it comes to professional regulation? Now what? So here it becomes trickier. Will Judaism accept the idea of regulating a profession in order to compensate for an apparent social problem? So you could say yes, but you could also argue no. And I'm going to give you an example in a separate field, not in law. The issue of rent control. Rent control in Judaism is a fascinating topic. Rent control legislation, as you know, is created by government with an eye towards helping potential tenants by keeping their rent stable. However, it obviously disadvantages the landlord. And so the question has come up over time in Judaism, is rent control legislation legitimate within Judaism? And I brought you two sources on it, source 44 and source number 45. In source number 44, Rabbi Shimon Greenfield, writing, as you see, in Hungary, end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, opposed it. He said, no, it's bad for the landlord. You're harming the landlord. Government does not have the right to insist on it. And therefore, this is not called Dina de Malchuta, the law of the land, such that Judaism would have to accept it. That's one view. Rabbi Yeshua Rokeach, on the other hand, writing in 19th century Poland, maybe early 20th, I'm not sure, but I wrote 19th century, so I think I probably had the date for his responsum, disagrees. And he says, no, if government is elected, they're entitled to determine what is good for the population as a whole, and therefore it is binding, is considered valid as the law of the land, and we will be responsible to listen to it. So you see a debate here regarding legislation which benefits some, but could harm others. One view says this counts as the law of the land because government, duly elected, is assigned the right of saying this is what society needs. Opposing view says no, you're not entitled to help one part of the population at the expense of another part of the population. So that's one question, is would this be recognized as law of the land from a Jewish perspective? Subject to debate. Down to this day, subject to debate. The other question is whether a rule set up by a professional regulatory body is the same as a rule by the government. Is that really the same thing? When Judaism says the law of the land is the law, dina de malchus adina, that we are obligated to follow laws that are set up by the government, does that include a law society regulation? On the one hand, I brought you source number 46 from Michael Broyd, in which he said the obligation to obey the secular law because it is the law of the land is inapplicable to disciplinary rules since they do not have the status of law in America. Now, that may be true in America. I'm not sure how this works in Canada because the government does assign to the government assigns to the law society regulation of the practice of law. So I'm not clear on whether his statement will really pertain to a law society setup. I don't know if anybody wants to weigh in on that interesting question. No?
Just offhand, I thought that the law society rules, yet were subordinate legislation. So I tend to think that they would have the force of law, but that would need to be confirmed.
Yeah. Okay. So my doubt is validated. Thank you. But what I'm trying to say overall is that when you get into regulation for the sake of ethical conduct, you find a basis for saying we want society to benefit, we want access to justice for everybody. But when it comes to regulating the profession and potentially harming some while helping others, that becomes a little bit more dicey. Last of our questions. Does Judaism believe in the value of symbolic affirmations? This was a big objection that I heard from people, that it's all symbolic. Going back to the line that we had before, where we said, you can just say, I acknowledge human rights, whatever, and that's it. Like, where is the meaning in that? So, what would you say? Does Judaism believe in the value of symbolic affirmations? I've got Zevi shaking his head no. Yeah?
I'm guessing yes, but don't ask me where.
You're guessing yes, because I'm asking the question at all.
Well, there's Mar Zion, right, which is maybe not symbolic, but we certainly care about people's perceptions.
We do care about perceptions, you're right. I recited a symbolic affirmation this morning. Right? Hopefully others did as well. It was called Shema. Right? I have a mitzvah that twice a day I am supposed to say, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. That statement is one I am supposed to make. It doesn't have any teeth to it, right? Nonetheless, it becomes a requirement, and a very serious biblical requirement, for me to recite Shema. Not only that, but Jews down through the ages have added symbolic affirmations. I noted for you in source number 47 from Rabbi Yechiel Michal Epstein in Aruch HaShulchan, in which he talks about a practice called the Sheish Zichirot, the six commemorations. I don't know how many people here say them, but they're found in a Sidur. There are six things that a Jew is called upon to remember with biblical verses, and there are people who recite them daily. And you can see the list there in source number 47. Remembering the Exodus from Egypt, remembering the presentation of the Torah, remembering Amalek, remembering the angering God in the wilderness, remembering Miriam, and remembering Shabbat. And the Aruch HaShulchan, Rabbi Epstein, says, you know, there's no obligation for a person to recite these. Remembering the Exodus from Egypt is a daily biblical duty, but we fulfill it when we say Shema. Remembering Amalek, biblical duty once a year. Right? Remembering Shabbat on Shabbat. I don't have a duty to mention that every morning. But there is a sense of value in this kind of recitation. And once I mention this one, some of you may recall that people have the practice of reciting the 13 Animamins. Right? 13 declarations of faith built around Maimonides' principles of faith. Right? There's even a version that's a song in Yigdal. Like, we do have symbolic affirmations within Judaism. They are considered to be meaningful, even if they don't have teeth. So I think there is a precedent in Judaism for that. Last point, an observation. And Michael, thank you for putting that in the chat as well. The Torah on, having additional verses about the importance of acting on behalf of the vulnerable. But here's what I think is a lot of the core of the problem here. It's that a role has been misassigned. And what I mean by that is that historically, religion had the role of doing what the Law Society is now trying to do. Meaning, telling people that racism is bad. Telling people that we should be looking to include the vulnerable, that we're supposed to take care of them. These are things that religion was supposed to take care of in terms of education and in terms of enforcement. I brought you sources 48 and 49. 48 is a passage from the Talmud about how rabbinical courts were responsible to enforce the ethics of businesses, making sure that people had proper weights and measures. In source number 49 from the Rambam, Rabbi Moses Maimonides, talking about having, again, rabbinically enacted patrols to make sure that people were not sinning to engage in regulating public morality. Leave aside how you feel about that personally. That's a way other discussion. My point isn't to get into that with 3 minutes remaining. My point is to say that historically, it was the job of religion, certainly in Judaism, I think in Christianity as well, and likely in Islam, frankly, to oversee, to educate, and to enforce morality, what was seen as the morally right thing to do. But in contemporary Canadian society, religion does not fill that role. In some cases, because people don't necessarily accept religion. In some cases, frankly, because religious leaders have let down the public and acted in ways that discredited religious authority. It's been a team effort to reduce the role of religion in society. But fundamentally, you now have a problem, because society recognizes that these values affect daily life, and there has to be an authority that's going to do something about it. So, in the manner of our litigious society, when we don't have a public moral body that's going to do it, we turn to regulators and we turn to government and say, okay, you make everybody do this. And it's not really a good match. I think that's where a lot of this is coming from. EDI should have been the province of those who are supposed to teach morality. But it had to become a process of regulation. That's just my gut. I don't know. Other feelings on that? Agree? Disagree?
It's true. I certainly agree. I mean, there's no moral imperative anymore. When you talk about morality, what did you mean? You can't even use the word sin. I mean, if you use the word sin today, it's like you're like some religious fanatic.
Yeah.
These concepts seem to fall by the wayside.
Right. So I'm just...
I agree as well. I think Rabbi Sacks in his last book, Rabbi Sacks in many of his books, but he emphasizes that in his last book on morality, it's a similar theme. When we lose morality, we lose the sense of community that is historical.
Mm-hmm.
Historically brings people together, and without that, then secular authorities start taking on that role.
Right. Oh, thank you. Then I'm glad to have thought of an idea that he has also. Hold on 1 second. Sergio and Susan, I see you both. Just wanted to note, there are review questions on the sheet, but also, before people go, if you didn't sign in the beginning, if you registered in advance, you're fine. But if you didn't register in advance, make sure, please, that you send me a note in the chat or email me or something so that I know that you were here, especially if you want a credit letter. Yes, yeah, Sergio, and then Susan.
We circle back to what Rabbi Lanzer, Colonel Lebracha, said about civil rights has become the new religion, because religion has been displaced from regular daily life in a great measure for a variety of reasons. So we're going back, and what we're experiencing right now is basically an onslaught of religious zealotry in the form of the civil discourse that is forcing certain type of language, certain type of behavior that is not part of the natural evolution that we have seen since the 60s to now, in which slowly but surely minorities have been integrated into society. Now there is a determined effort by a segment of the population to cram down, whether you like it or not, certain type of values that you may disagree with, or you may think too extreme.
Mm-hmm. I hear you. I hear you. I'm not going
to...
You know what? Just 1 second, Jules. Jules, hang in there for 1 second. Sorry, because Susan was waiting, and then you. Susan?
I'm sorry that my screen doesn't work. It's an old computer. I apologize. Just to throw in a comment from an educator's point of view with regards to the changes in society and the topic of ethics generally, for people who were studying educational theory earlier, the concept of mainstream belief and mainstream values was extirpated out of the education system early in the 1970s, and the word values education became very difficult for anybody in government-regulated areas to deal with. So what they understood as mainstream values are people who had originally been having a common thread through what they believed and what their ethical education was, seemed to disappear or be devalued by whatever government sources controlled education. And I think it spread over the whole society, including the problem in terms of any education in different communities, Jewish education included.
Right, I hear you. It is something that would be worth, you know, really looking at the sociology of it and tracing that through. So thank you very much. Thanks for adding that. Jules.
I throw this out simply. Why isn't this the problem of the Attorney General and not the Law Society? When all the stuff from COVID, the public perceives it the problem of the government and the Ministry of Health, not of the College of Physicians.
Right. I think because the government has duly kicked regulating law over to the Law Society and doesn't want to be involved anymore. I think that's why. I think the College of Physicians and COVID is an interesting question in its own right. I think it has to do with the fact that the College of Physicians is not empowered to do anything with its public health recommendations, and that necessitates government getting involved. And at that point, they can't extricate themselves and say, well, blame the College of Physicians. I think that's probably, you know, why government gets involved with COVID and doesn't get involved with this. This, they've handed off to the Law Society, and they're really happy for the Law Society to manage this with the lawyers. That would be my gut. All right. Anybody who needs to go can go. I'm going to stick around for a few minutes for questions, but thank you, everybody, very much for participating.
Yeah, I think there's one thing. Can I mention it?
Yeah, please. Go ahead, Moshe.